Miss Simone Biles will be back in action later at the Xfinity U.S. Gymnastics Championships in San Jose, California.
It's the most decorated lineup of competitors ever as the women vie for positions on the Paris Olympics gymnastics team. The Summer Games are less than a year away now. NBC News correspondent Emily Akeda joins us now with more on what we can expect. Emily, good morning.
Hey there, guys. Well, all eyes, of course, will be on the formidable force that is Simone Biles, seven-time Olympic medalist and fresh off her win at the Core Hydration Classic just 2 weeks ago and looking like her old self. But she isn't the only big name competing today. Suni Lee, Jordan Chiles, among others, will also be part of the mix as the prep for the 2024 Summer Olympic Games heats up.
It's the next step in her historic comeback. Simone Biles set to take the floor in the U.S. Gymnastics Championships later today. Fresh off her all-around win 2 weeks ago at the Core Hydration Classic, Biles is reminding people why she's the most decorated gymnast ever. But Biles isn't the only star at this year's championship. All-around 2020 Olympic champion Suni Lee, as well as Olympic teammate and silver medalist Jordan Chiles, are just part of this powerhouse field. Competition is fierce to qualify for an elusive and exclusive spot on the 2024 Olympic team.
This competition will allow all athletes that compete a chance to make national team. And what that does is it qualifies them to go ahead and compete and try out for Worlds come this fall.
But aside from all the athletic star power that will be on display in San Jose, this competition offers an opportunity to shine a positive light on a sport that has been riddled in scandal in recent years.
We have been failed, and we deserve answers.
Speaking on Capitol Hill in 2021, Biles slammed the, quote, entire system for enabling sexual abuse.
While acknowledging what has happened in the past, we can still continue to move forward and be strong.
In the Tokyo Olympic Games, Biles stunned the world, withdrawing from most of her events in 2021.
And wow.
It looked like she got almost lost in the air.
Biles saying the pressure and emotional toll of the Olympics led to a case of the twisties, where gymnasts can get disoriented in the air.
I had no idea where I was in the air. You could literally see it in my eyes in the pictures. Like, I was petrified.
She's since used her platform to highlight the importance of mental health and seems to have her confidence back on the mat. Now, all eyes will be on the 4'11" dynamo, who will try to twist, turn, and explode her way to another championship.
And guys, remember, we are less than a year out from the Olympic Games, and so the pressure is on for these athletes to perform, trying to earn a coveted spot first on the national team. That will influence who gets to make Worlds, and that in turn influences who lands one of the five elusive spots for the Olympic teams. And it really feels like right now that it's harder than ever to break through, especially with so many veteran athletes competing.
For many, learning how to swim is a rite of passage, but a surprising number of American children can't swim. Part of that comes down to access and restrictions rooted in racism that have kept generations of swimmers out of pools. Isabella Chabilia of Rhode Island PBS explores the fight for swim safety.
One night, phone call, woman sobbing on the phone, telling me that her child had drowned at 5 o'clock at Lincoln Woods.
It was the early 90s, and Ray Rickman was a Rhode Island state representative. It was that phone call from a grieving mother that sent Rickman on a new path, advocating for water safety.
She watched her son drown. She could not swim. Can you imagine? You can't imagine.
In the United States, an average of 11 people are drowning every day.
Mara Gay was an avid swimmer growing up. Today, she's on the New York Times editorial board and has written about swim access and safety.
So we're losing 4,000 people a year to drowning. It's the leading cause of death for children from 1 to 4. Drowning is something that affects Americans of all backgrounds.
Editor's note, interruption, special news alert. I am going to put in an unshameless plug for the Capital District YMCA, which has always, or at least for decades, done a lot about swim safety, urban swim safety, and other issues.
However, it does disproportionately affect minorities.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Black children are 1.5 times more likely, and Native American children are 2 times more likely than white children to die of drowning. Gay says for Black Americans, that gap is rooted in slavery.
So Black Americans, many people know, were not allowed to learn how to read during slavery. Many times they also weren't allowed to learn how to swim. And that's because it would have made it easier to escape to freedom Dogs couldn't track your scent in water, which was known among enslaved Americans. During segregation, you had public pools that were not open to Black Americans.
Even after segregation ended, many Black Americans were still unwelcome. Storyteller V. Ruffini grew up in Rhode Island.
Pools weren't segregated, but they were racist. And when we got there, we dealt with the racism. I can remember them calling us names like the walking Tootsie Roll, or there's a Hershey bar in the pool. And, you know, all straight out coming out with the N-word.
But intimidation wasn't the only way African-Americans were driven out of pools.
Many communities across the South, but also elsewhere, unfortunately, chose to fill in, destroy, or close their public pools rather than allow Black Americans to swim in them. So white, wealthier Americans who were able to started forming their own clubs, their own neighborhood associations that were, of course, segregated, and the rest of America was shut out.
Wayne Willis and his family are working to reverse that trend through their business, Orca Aquatics. His son, Dylan, coaches the swim team.
One, two, three.
And his daughter, Sydney, and wife, Joanna, give swim lessons. Some of these students are able to learn for free thanks to former state representative Ray Rickman.
Our number one goal is to teach now low-income children to swim and to avoid drowning.
He started a program called Swim Empowerment to sponsor swim lessons for Black and low-income youth. 2,600 children have learned to swim through the program so far.
The reason so many Americans can't swim is because they don't have safe places to learn to do so. Public pools are the critical piece of this puzzle. So it would be the equivalent of calling for education for all Americans without having any schools.
In August, a chlorine explosion shut down the pool where Orca Aquatics holds its lessons. Until the damage is fixed, they're teaching at a different pool, but have had to cut back swim lessons from 7 days a week to three. The shortage of pools in the area has inspired Ray Rickman to expand his mission.
A $20 million Olympic Plus swimming pool for the people of Providence to come free to swim. And we're going to get it done.
Rickman hopes that one day everyone in his community will have a place to swim. For PBS News Weekend, I'm Isabella Jabilian in Providence, Rhode Island.
You're watching PBS.
I'm Chantel Desha. This week on New York Now, we sit down with Assemblymember Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas to discuss a bill that would allow the state to provide increased SNAP benefits to households.
You could do very little with $23 in this day and age. A dozen eggs cost like about $6 right now. So it is really critical that we ensure that the SNAP program is actually meeting the needs of families to ensure that we are able to thrive in this state. The governor said that we should have a more livable, affordable, and safer state, and this contributes to addressing food insecurity, contributes to that.
How much would this program cost the state?
So what the program would do is look at the minimum federal benefit, which, again, the very minimum is $23, and would ensure that we're providing at least $95. I actually will be amending the bill to make it about $100 even, because New Jersey just passed this bill and currently has it at $95. So we have to be better than New Jersey. But it will create essentially a program that's funded by the state to make up that difference, whatever that difference is, so that every person, every household is at least getting $100 a month in federal SNAP benefits. The costs are yet to be determined. In New Jersey, it's about $38 million, but certainly we have to look at the people enrolled in our state. So we're waiting on the fiscal. But what's promising is that also the comptroller came out with some anticipated revenues that were higher than what the Department of Budget put out. So there's some promising feedback in terms of revenue, but essentially it would come out of the budget, which is a moral document. So this is critical.
Sunday at midnight on WMHT or on demand at nynow.org.
Ooh. America has used to execute its criminals have changed over the years, from burning to drawing and quartering to hanging. Criminals have been axed, crucified, buried alive, pressed with weights, stoned, impaled, starved, decapitated, and gibbeted. Gibbeting is the hanging of the condemned man by chains to rot. Death often takes weeks to occur.
Which mob?
Today, the breakdown of execution methods looks like this. 17 states use lethal injection. The electric chair is employed in 15 states. Lethal gas is the choice in 7 states. 3 states still hang their condemned. And 2 states execute prisoners by firing squad.
Lynch mob.
As of 1987, Florida led the nation with 277 inmates awaiting death. Texas was second with 257, and California was third with 219. The youngest person facing death was 16 years old.
Lynch mob.
In the United States, public executions occasionally led to violence among the crowd and senseless tragedy for a few unfortunate witnesses.
Lynch mob.
The last public execution in America was on August 14, 1946. Nearly 20,000 people showed up to watch the hanging death of Rainey Bethea, a black man accused of raping a white woman.
Well, they sold lemonade on the grounds, and of course the saloons did a bump of business and all of that, and everybody had a good time, and the mob was just totally unruly. Mob was just totally unruly. Mob was just totally unruly.
American history is just that, his story. It wasn't even her story because her didn't have the pen. The Thomas Jeffersons of the world, the Lockes, the Paines, the Machiavellis, the Descartes, the Shakespeares. There were some women, no doubt. But the point is, history is not necessarily reality. And some of these songs give you a different perspective because you're talking about things you don't normally hear about, at least not the larger community. Also, that's why this new show, The Dialogue News Show, gives you different diverse news, whether it's cancer rates among black women or infant mortality rates or stuff about clean energy. I'm reading some stuff recently, New York Times and other things, whether it's oil production in America. Republicans and conservatives love to talk about Democrats trying to, you know, restrict supply and all this stuff. We talked ad nauseum on the show about supply demand, meaning even though there's different parts of the oil industry, obviously extraction, exploration, refineries, different types of production, right? So now you might be saying, what about global warming or climate change? But the point is, the conservatives want to use all these make-believe issues that they don't help solve. And, for instance, with exploration, you can't just keep drilling if you don't refine it. Right? The border. They're not trying to fix the border. Republicans want to scream about the open borders being open. What about the U.S. legal ports? What about the cargo containers? Less than 3% are being inspected? Hello? Google it. Where's the fentanyl coming in? Google that and say cargo containers. It's not coming in some backpack with some dude going through the desert, 150 degrees with heat index. Are you serious? I'm not sure about fentanyl and cocaine, but I think it would melt in that kind of heat or get hot and sweaty. Not sure. But the point is, again, made up issues. If you want to solve the border, solve it. The dope is getting in through open ports, open drive-through lanes, etc. Hello? They Trump killed DACA, and Republicans could have put another plan in place. They want to pound the gavel. The guy's screaming at a general recently. Have you been to the border? Well, have you tried passing a bill to fix the border? Clown show people? Let's educate ourselves. And calling someone clown show people may not be educated, but if you're looking at a circus, what are you going to call it? A bar mitzvah? A promenade? No, it's a freaking clown show. Hello? 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 Is there anybody there? McFly, are you home, bruh? You want to go back to the 50s, live back and leave it to Beaverland, and you're living like McFly. Ain't nobody home. Bats in the belfry? Something like that. Come on, man. Come on, man. Get your knee off my neck. It's 2023. It's a new day. Change is inevitable. Ain't nobody taking your country. What you gonna get back? You want your country back? Where did it go? Did somebody sell it or something? What does that mean? Does it mean black people are in charge? You know, black chiefs of staff or black presidents? And you can't handle that? I don't get it. Or that women now have power, some power and some more control, and you don't like that? You guys are going ape nuts over black Kamala VP Harris. You're right? Trying to shift the argument now about old Biden. Or we don't want Kamala. There's a lot of real issues we need to solve and resolve and get on and get up, right? Will Hill. Hill Harper. I'm sorry, Will. Hill Harper. He said, I will not be bossed, bought, or bullied. Okay? Welcome to the Dialogue News Show. Back to the news.
Of Congress. It is Congress's responsibility to fund the federal government, a power given to the House and Senate in the Constitution of the United States. It's called the Appropriations Clause. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7 reads, quote, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law, end quote. This is a simple duty laid out in black and white.
What we could do is just adapt the code of conduct that the other court systems have in order to reflect those slight or certain differences. And I think it would be a good thing for the court to do that.
That was Justice Elena Kagan calling for the Supreme Court to adopt an ethics code just hours after another bombshell report on Justice Clarence Thomas. The new ProPublica report details Thomas's years-long personal relationship with Republican billionaires Charles and David Koch. That friendship developed over years of trips to a secretive male-only enclave called the Bohemian Grove. In this photo, you see Thomas with David Koch. ProPublica reports that Thomas rubbed elbows at the Bohemian Grove with the Kochs and billionaire Harlan Crowe. The report also reveals that over the years, Thomas secretly attended at least two donor events for the Koch network, putting Thomas in the extraordinary position of having served as a fundraising draw for a right-wing network that has invested a lot of money into an upcoming Supreme Court case. The case revisits a long-standing precedent known as Chevron versus National Resources Defense Council. Conservatives have been asking the court to overrule Chevron, which would limit the power of federal agencies to issue regulations in areas ranging from the environment to labor rights. The Koch network has long pushed to see Chevron overturned. Justice Thomas did not respond to an NBC News request for comment on the ProPublica reporting. And the Koch network denies any wrongdoing, telling ProPublica, quote, The idea that attending a couple of events to promote a book or give dinner remarks, as all justices do, could somehow be of undue influence just doesn't hold water, end quote. Let's see how much water it holds. Joining me now is retired judge Ladoris Hazard Cordell, who served on the California Superior Court. And back with us is Michigan law professor Leah Lippman. Judge, how damning is this new report on Justice Thomas? And aren't judges supposed to disclose this kind of activity and avoid participating in fundraising of any kind?
The answer to that is yes. But let me just take us back just real quickly. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan used this racist trope of the welfare queen when he was running for president. And he used it to characterize black women as being on welfare, lazy, looking for handouts. And he vowed to reform welfare in America. Well, Clarence Thomas jumped on that bandwagon, and over the years, he has disparaged even a member of his own family for being lazy and getting a handout on welfare. Thomas has been receiving handouts for years from the Koch brothers, among others, that dwarf the welfare payments complained of by Reagan and his ilk. So Clarence Thomas has replaced the welfare queen. He is the undisputed welfare king. So in terms of ethics, it's absolutely easy to be ethical. It's easy because all you have to do is be transparent and be above board. It's hard to be unethical because you have to engage in deceit, you have to lie, you have to cover up, you break the rules and break the law. So the ethical code holds people accountable, and it's especially important with judges. Why? And let's just look at the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court justices are paid by their salaries are paid by us, by taxpayers. So it is especially important that we hold them accountable because they are taking our money. That's where their salaries are paid. So of course it is important. And what this Supreme Court, I mean, it's stunning for me to hear a smart person like Justice Elena Kagan say, well, now maybe we should maybe have some rules on ethics. It goes without saying that that should be the case. Uh-huh. And for them to now think about maybe we should is, to me, it's in a way, it's insulting, I think, to those of us who care about the courts. So, yes, judges need to be ethical, they need to be transparent, and there needs to be a code of ethics for the Supreme Court.
But Leah, this isn't just about a code of ethics or failing to disclose certain interactions. Justice Thomas is actually going to be hearing arguments in a case that seeks to overturn Chevron. And this is something that conservative interests have long desired. One, what would the impact of a decision overruling Chevron have on the lives of everyday Americans? And again, why is it so important that Justice Thomas is on this case at a time when he's hobnobbing with these billionaires?
Overruling Chevron would have momentous consequences for government as we know it. The federal government said in its brief that it would send a convulsive shock throughout the legal system. What it would do is it would take power away from administrative agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency or the Food and Drug Administration, and it would give that power to the federal courts, including the Supreme Court, which are currently dominated by Republicans and will be for the next few decades. So it's a massive power grab by regulated interests like the Koch network, you know, to hand over power mm-hmm. to a group that they think is more sympathetic to their interests than these federal agencies, which are tasked with considering the public interest and not just the interest of money capital. And it is a huge deal that Justice Thomas, you know, is on the court to hear this case at this time, because actually Justice Thomas's views on deference to agencies have evolved since he has been on the court. He used to be a pretty strong proponent of the federal courts deferring to administrative agencies. And then over the last few decades, somehow his views have changed. Now, why is that? It's hard to say, but it's also hard to deny that what the Koch network is doing is exactly like the manufacturers of pharmaceuticals and opioids were doing, giving all of this free trips and free gifts to doctors. And all of a sudden, those doctors were prescribing more drugs. And why was that? It's hard to say. And these donors are cultivating access to the Supreme Court and ensuring that they are in their milieu so they are listening to what mm-hmm. these donors have to say.
So, Judge Cordell, Senator Dick Durbin, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has called out Justice Thomas for this, quote, gaggle of fawning billionaires and how he hid the extent of his involvement with the Koch network and never reported these gifts. He wants Justice Thomas to recuse himself from this upcoming case. Is that likely to happen?
I want Justice Thomas to recuse himself from this case. And is it likely to happen? Well, there is no laws, there are no rules that require him to recuse himself. And recusal in the Supreme Court is left to the justices themselves. Mm-hmm. So will Clarence Thomas step up and say, oh, I don't think I should hear this case because the appearance of impropriety, I'm getting all this money from the Koch brothers, and if I decide in their favor, it's just not going to look good? No, he's not going to do it. Okay. I can tell you that right now. So he won't recuse himself. And the result of that will be that this court will bring more shame to the Supreme Court. It'll further damage its already failing reputation. But there's a positive side to this. And that is, it's going to give more encouragement to those of us seeking to reform the court.
Mm-hmm. So, Leah, this may give some more fire to those who are seeking court reform, but Justice Thomas is not the only justice with a recusal problem. So this term, the court is going to hear another case. This case is a tax case, and it's going to be argued by David Rifkin. And David Rifkin is not just any lawyer. He is also a sometimes journalist who Justice Alito recently gave a Wall Street Journal interview to, in which Justice Alito lashed out at recent criticism of the court. Given this association between the justice and Rifkin, should Justice Alito also consider recusing himself from that very important tax case?
He absolutely should consider it. Unfortunately, he rejected calls to recuse himself in an angry statement he released, you know, just a few weeks ago, in which he said, it's no big deal because every Supreme Court justice gives interviews to media outlets, even though in none of those other parties did a justice give, you know, an on-the-record interview behind closed doors for several hours with a lawyer who is representing a party before the Supreme Court. And in another case, the Supreme Court is going to hear this term involving the CFPB, you know, the person who flew Justice Alito on a private jet to Alaska has several millions of dollars of stake in companies that are regulated by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the agency that the challengers are asking the Supreme Court to hobble. So there are actually several cases in which, again, the justices, you know, professional network that has actively cultivated influence and access, you know, to the justices has real interest at stake in cases that the Supreme Court is hearing.
All right, Judge, I want to just play one more clip for you. Justice Thomas promotes himself as an everyman, so here's a clip of him telling us in his own words.
I prefer the RV parks. I prefer the Walmart parking lots to the beaches and things like that. There's something normal to me about it. I've come from regular stock, and I prefer that. I prefer being around that.
Yes or no answer. Do you believe it?
No, absolutely not. That the man made the comments in the parking lot riding in this huge RV that was worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. There's your everyman. Please. This man needs to just stop talking. He needs to recuse himself. And actually, I think he should be off the court.
Major problem for the majority of us living in this country. These calls are not innocent words made in a vacuum. We have already seen what can happen when Trump speaks. And all you have to do is watch video from the assault on our Capitol. As The Atlantic points out, academics have a formal term for exactly this type of incitement, stochastic terrorism. An influential figure with a large following demonizes a person or a group of people. The likelihood is strong that some small number of followers will take those words literally. These are incredibly dangerous incitements to violence. And Trump didn't stop there. He continued his deranged rants, calling NBC, and specifically this network, MSNBC, an enemy of the people worthy of investigation and prosecution for treason. Now, the rest of the media can lead with questions about Biden's age, but don't you think that it's a little more consequential to ask the American people if they support threats of violence against an army general and calls to retaliate against the media, maybe violently. Sadly, this country has become so numb towards Trump and his party's openly authoritarian threats that he doesn't even have to hide what he wants to do in a second term. Aside from his threats against General Milley and those who work at this network, Trump has plans to bomb Mexico, an act of war, by the way, plus firing hundreds of thousands of career civil servants who refuse to do whatever he wants, herding homeless people into camps, cutting funding to schools that teach critical race theory and gender ideology, which isn't actually a thing in public schools, reinstating a Muslim ban while expanding the ban to include, quote, communists, Marxists, and socialists. Watch out, France, the Netherlands, Italy, and Germany, all countries that have socialist political parties. He would also ban funds for transgender care and send national troops to major cities to essentially implement martial law. Oh, and defund the FBI. And that doesn't even include his desire to permanently stay in power and his plans to nationalize a ban on abortion access. America, is this what you really want?
Funky president. Funky president.
Funky. Down. Nasty.
Hey, listen to the man.
Well, Godfather.
Payback.
Cold-blooded.
Should be rewarding a Republican Party that is bringing this country to its economic knees with a possible government shutdown just because Trump told them to? And because they don't want to help feed the poor or lower the cost of prescription drugs or support the fight for democracy in Ukraine? Do you really think that we should reward people who are paid to govern but who refuse to do their jobs? Trump seems to think so. He's telling Republicans to shut down the government unless they get, quote, everything, including, of course, impeaching Joe Biden for whatever they think of today. And the very real threat of a shutdown, amid that threat, Republicans found time to hold a hearing on that this week. Biden. Perfect. Joining me now is Steve Schmidt, former Republican strategist and founder of The Warning newsletter, podcast, and YouTube channel. It is great to have you back, Steve. I don't even know where to begin, so I am just going to let you respond to that. Because the thing is that Donald Trump is being very open about what a second Trump term, which would be a permanent, apparently, Trump term, would entail. What do you make of the fact that it does seem to me that the country, and in many cases the media, seems numb to it?
I think there's no question that the country and the media is numb to it. The threshold in this moment is very simple. Everything that Donald Trump says should be taken literally and seriously. What he did today was threaten the employees, the journalists at NBC News. What he said more broadly is he's going to shut down the free media in the United States. What he announced today as a candidate for president in 2023 is he's coming after the American media. He's coming after his political opponents. Why is he running for president? He's running for retribution. Retribution, according to Donald Trump, is a philosophy of avenging anybody who was against him. So we are on the edge of an abyss in this country, and it seems that there is a paralysis, a numbness, a total disregard for the clear and present threat. There is something extraordinary happening. The people who are trying to tear down democracy in the country keep telling the rest of the country what it is they plan to do, to such a degree that they have announced their plans 6 months into 2025 to have taken apart the whole of the federal government. Now, since FDR's time in office, the legislative metric in the United States has been 100 days, not 6 months. This is a racist code whistle to every white supremacist in the country, because it's how long it took Adolf Hitler to take Weimar Germany to a complete and total dictatorship. That included, by the way, the military swearing an oath of allegiance, not to the nation, but to the Führer. And the military was the institution amongst many in Germany that were the last holdouts to this. But once he was in power, they were the first to submit. And what Donald Trump is signaling to the officer corps of the American military, you get in line behind me, the leader, not the idea, not the Constitution, or I'm coming for you too. This is an epically dangerous moment.
Well, and to make that even more explicit, he has essentially threatened General Mark Milley with death. And he has signaled to his MAGA fanatic fan base that this man deserves to die. This is a hero military United States general that was the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he explicitly issued a threat against him because he knows there will be no recourse and that his followers have no problem with that. But his party has no problem with it. Where is the condemnation from the Republican Party for Donald Trump issuing a written threat against General Milley? I've heard nothing but silence.
Total silence, as there has been total silence about the threats, about the intimations towards violence that we've seen play out over many years. There will be a moment where these intimations and threats trigger actual real violence. There are strong arguments to be made that it has already. We know for certain that radicalized individuals have acted. We know for certain, having watched with our own eyes on January 6th, how the incitements translate to violence. But it seems to me that there is something growing, growling, menacing out there, and it is not being confronted. Now, I do want to say this. The Democratic Party, in its entirety, must condemn Senator Robert Menendez, roll him up in a carpet, and proverbially throw him over the side of the deck, because corruption accrues to Donald Trump's benefit. Chaos accrues to Donald Trump's benefit. If the race is about, well, both sides are corrupt, even if it's a false equivalence, it accrues to Trump's benefit. The only way out of this, the only way through this, is an appeal to better. So the country has been in a profound crisis before. It is a feature of democracies that they awaken late to threats. Winston Churchill talked about the gathering storm. He talked about the Second World War as the unnecessary war. But what is coming is nearing. And when you have a former president so unhinged today, threatening a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or current chairman about to retire with death, threatening journalists with shutdown and violence, and threatening to imprison political opponents, it has to be taken seriously. When you have the entirety of a political party that remains silent, they are complicit with it. I mean, we are at the hour that John Kennedy warned about when he said, beware the foolish men who seek power by trying to ride the back of the tiger only to wind up inside it. That's where we are. And so this moment requires a ability to communicate the threat, but also optimistically, where are we going as we move away from this? But nobody should be confused at all about how close we are to the edge of the abyss in this country. Judging from Donald Trump's words, he means it.
Well, he means it, and his party means it as well. I mean, DeSantis, who's considered for a while was supposed to be one of the alternatives, is saying that they're going to start, quote, slitting throats if he becomes a president from day one. You have Ramaswamy promising to pardon Trump and to implement many of the same authoritarian principles, rob people under 25 of their right to vote, reinstitute what he's calling a civics test, meaning some sort of, I guess, bubbles in a bar of soap or whatever it is he thinks he wants to go back to. But I want to talk about like how this happens. And by the way, we are going to have the opponent, the Democratic opponent, named opponent to Senator Menendez on later in the show, because I think you're right about him. How this happens, Steve, is not a one-on-one necessarily between Biden and Trump. Trump has already proven he's a loser. He's a multiple times loser when he and his, you know, his versions of him run in the last couple of years' elections. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has had now conversations with the Libertarian Party about maybe leaving the Democratic primary and trying to run as a Libertarian. You've got all of these third party candidates out there floating around, Cornel West, him. The way this could happen is that you have four people on the ballot, and you do have a critical mass of Americans who either through boredom or disinterest in democracy don't want to reelect a normal president. They want an outre president. How concerned are you that these third-party potential candidates, some of them conspiracy theorists, et cetera, like Mr. Kennedy, could actually put Trump back in office?
Well, at the end of the day, there's a reality about American democracy, which is this, is if you're constitutionally qualified and over 35 years of old and you want to run for office, you can run for office. And the Democratic Party as an institution doesn't get a vote on it. The Republican Party doesn't get a vote on it. Life isn't fair. Political campaigns aren't fair. Some people get to run downhill. Other people have to run uphill. And here's the deal, right? If there's three candidates on the ballot, five candidates on the ballot, Cornel West is on the ballot, Joe Manchin is on the ballot, Joe Biden must be able to put together a strategy that assembles 270 electoral votes. Now, what it does at a basic level is it expands the electoral map, and that means you go to places that haven't seen candidates, bigger race, more complicated, but you have to win the game as it's presented to you. And that's the challenge for the Democrats and the president on this.
Indeed. We're going to have to keep talking about this. Steve Schmidt, always valuable to have your voice on this show, so please come back. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers. And up next,
one more issue for you to consider before we leave, and that's the relationship between business and your health. The GOP, conservatives, pro-business, they don't like regulation. Dump coal ash in the river, deregulate Ronald Reagan with the airlines. That doesn't help the average Joe or Jane. What is that doing for you?
This news story was written by Anahead O'Connor. Many of today's unhealthy foods were brought to you by Big Tobacco. A new study suggests that tobacco companies, who were skilled at marketing cigarettes, used similar strategies to hook people on processed foods. For decades, tobacco companies hooked people on cigarettes by making their products more addictive. Now, a new study suggests that tobacco companies may have used a similar strategy to hook people on processed foods.
What?
In the 1980s, tobacco giants Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds acquired the major food companies Kraft, General Foods, and Nabisco, allowing tobacco firms to dominate America's food supply and reap billions in sales from popular brands such as Oreo cookies, Kraft macaroni and cheese, and Lunchables.
Not for me.
By the 2000s, the tobacco giants spun off their food companies and largely exited the food industry, but not before leaving a lasting legacy on the foods that we eat. The new research, published in the journal Addiction, focuses on the rise of hyperpalatable foods, which contain potent combinations of fat, sodium, sugar, and other additives that can drive people to crave and overeat them. The addiction study found that in the decades when the tobacco giant owned the world's leading food companies, the foods that they sold were far more likely to be hyperpalatable than similar foods not owned by tobacco companies. In the past 30 years, hyperpalatable foods have spread rapidly into the food supply, coinciding with a surge in obesity and diet-related diseases. In America, the steepest increase in the prevalence of hyperpalatable foods occurred between 1988 and 2001, the era when Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds owned the world's leading food companies. Even though the tobacco companies no longer own these food brands, researchers say the findings matter because many of the ultra-processed foods that we eat today were engineered by an industry that wrote the playbook on products that are highly palatable, addictive, and appealing to children. We found that tobacco companies selectively disseminated hyperpalatable foods into the food supply, said Tara Fazzino, the lead author of the new study and an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Kansas. It's important for people to understand where these foods came from and who was responsible for putting them into our food system in a way that saturates the environment. How cigarette makers sold food. For their study, Fazzino and her colleagues pored over documents contained in the University of California at San Francisco's Industry Documents Library, which contains millions of internal tobacco industry documents that shed light on how the companies designed their products to be addictive and the strategies they used to market them. Fazzino and her colleagues identified 105 foods that were among the best-selling products for brands owned by either Philip Morris or R.J. Reynolds between 1988 and 2001. At the time, R.J. Reynolds owned Nabisco, whose popular brands included Oreo cookies, Teddy Graham's, Ritz crackers, and Snackwell's fat-free Devil's food cookies. Philip Morris once owned the world's largest food company, Kraft General Foods, which sold popular brands like Kraft Mac and Cheese, Jell-O, Kool-Aid, and Oscar Mayer hot dogs. The researchers compared the nutritional makeup of these foods to 587 similar products sold by competing brands that were not owned by tobacco companies. They found that tobacco-owned foods were 80% more likely to contain potent combinations of carbs and sodium that made them hyperpalatable. Tobacco-owned brands were also 29% more likely to contain similarly potent combinations of fat and sodium. Foods that find your bliss point. The findings suggest that tobacco companies engineered processed foods to hit what is known as our bliss point and elicit cravings, said Ashley Gearhart, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan who studies food addiction. She said that hyperpalatable foods have a lot in common with addictive substances. They contain ingredients from naturally occurring plants and foods that have been purified, concentrated, and transformed into products that are quickly absorbed into our bloodstreams, which amplifies their ability to light up reward centers in our brains. Every addictive substance is something that we take from nature and we alter it, process it, and refine it in a way that makes it more rewarding, and that is very clearly what happened with these hyperpalatable food substances, said Gearhart, who was not involved in the new study. We treat these foods like they come from nature. Instead, they're foods that come from big tobacco. Philip Morris, which changed its name to Altria, declined to comment. R.J. Reynolds, Kraft and Mondelez, which owns Nabisco, did not respond to requests for comment. Experts in the flavor business. Tobacco companies got into the food business 60 years ago to diversify their product portfolios. These firms had extensive libraries of colors, flavors, and additives that they developed for cigarettes, and executives realized they could use these ingredients to make a variety of processed foods. In the 1960s, R.J. Reynolds launched a project to develop sugary drinks, which involved market research on children. In an internal memo that year, the company's manager of biochemical research wrote to an RJR executive that the firm was not merely a tobacco company. In a broader and much less restricting sense, he wrote, R.J. Reynolds is in the flavor business. The research manager noted that many of the flavors the company had developed for cigarettes would be useful in food, beverage, and other products, leading to large financial returns. Turning Hawaiian Punch into a kid's drink. The following year, RJR bought the maker of Hawaiian Punch, which at the time was a cocktail mixer that was available in only two flavors. After conducting dozens of market research studies in children and housewives, RJR expanded Hawaiian Punch to at least 16 flavors, including many preferred by kids. The company was among the first to introduce a nationally distributed juice box, which became an instant hit. They took something that was an adult cocktail mixer, and a year later, they had turned it into a children's beverage, said Laura Schmidt, a professor of health policy at the UCSF School of Medicine, who has published studies examining the tobacco industry's involvement in food companies. RJR used a cartoon mascot, Punchy, to market Hawaiian Punch to children. For decades, Punchy appeared in TV commercials, Sunday comics, schoolbook covers, toys and magazines, helping to generate tens of millions of dollars in sales and becoming what RJR called the best salesman the beverage has ever had. The rise of Teddy Grahams. Its success with Hawaiian Punch led RJR to expand into other foods, including puddings and maple syrup. Then in 1985, the tobacco giant acquired Nabisco, which catapulted the company into a dominant player in the food industry. The conglomerate went on to launch many successful new processed foods, including Teddy Grahams, a bite-sized children's snack that soon became the third best-selling cookie behind only Chips Ahoy and Oreo, both also produced by Nabisco. RJR Nabisco marketed Teddy Grahams as a delicious yet wholesome snack because they're made with Graham flour and other wholesome ingredients. Yet critics pointed out that the product was predominantly made from white flour and contained just 2 grams of Graham flour in a 1 ounce serving. The snack was so popular that Nabisco created an adult version of it, Honey Made Honeycomb Graham Snacks. Nabisco reasoned that the sweet taste and relatively healthful image could also hook adults, according to a 1990 New York Times article about the launch of the new snack. A couple years later, as the low-fat craze was underway, Nabisco introduced its wildly popular Snackwells cookies, which sold out in stores across the country, reaching sales of almost $500 million in only 3 years. Snackwells low-fat and fat-free cookies appealed to weight-conscious consumers. But the snacks contained plenty of sugar and calories, and critics pointed out that people would often binge on them because they believed they weren't fattening, a phenomenon known as the Snackwell effect. Marketing Kool-Aid and Lunchables. Nabisco was bought in 2000 by Philip Morris, which was already a dominant player in the food industry thanks to its acquisitions of Kraft and General Foods in the 1980s. Schmidt at UCSF said that when Philip Morris bought General Foods in 1985, it installed tobacco executives at the food company and launched initiatives to market sugary drinks and processed foods to children and minorities. To broaden the reach of its cigarettes, Philip Morris used a marketing strategy called line extensions. Marlboro cigarettes were marketed to men, Virginia Slims targeted women, and menthol cigarettes were heavily advertised to black consumers. The company applied the same tactic to processed foods, Schmidt said. It added new flavors and formulas to many of its existing products, giving consumers an endless variety of hyperpalatable foods to buy. Between 1986 and 2004, Philip Morris developed a dozen new products of liquid and frozen Kool-Aid and introduced around 36 child-tested flavors, including Kickin' Kiwi Lime and Great Blue Dini, which had its own cartoon mascot. One of its best-selling products, Lunchables, was introduced in 1988 by Oscar Mayer. Designed to look like a TV dinner and marketed to busy moms and their children, the iconic, prepackaged meal of bologna, crackers, and processed cheese contained so much sodium and saturated fat that some doctors called it a blood pressure bomb. One Philip Morris executive joked about references that the healthiest item in a package of Lunchables was the napkin. According to Salt Sugar Fat, the best-selling book by investigative journalist Michael Moss, Lunchables had sales of $218 million in its first 12 months on the market. This prompted Oscar Mayer to introduce line extensions such as Lunchables with Snickers bars, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, Kool-Aid, and Capri Sun. By the early 2000s, Philip Morris was mired in tobacco lawsuits. Moss said the company's leadership warned its food site executives that they could face a similar risk of litigation over the health effects of processed foods. One senior Kraft executive named Michael Mudd, Moss said, reviewed the company's records and products and told a Philip Morris lawyer he was worried that some of its cookies and processed foods could drive people to eat compulsively. The tobacco companies are no longer in the food business, but the impact they had on the food supply was substantial.
We've reached the end of episode number 152 of the Dialogue News Show. I am news anchor Barry Barometer. giving you the news that you don't normally get on your news channel. Thank you. And remember,
body-worn camera will be activated prior to citizen engagement during a self-initiated stop.
Get your knee off my neck.
Hi, this is Dan Carter, host of ODARK 30. Tune in every Tuesday morning from 6 to 8 a.m. to hear roots Americana and pop music from the 60s and 70s, a little bit of jazz, funk, and I like to emphasize local artists whenever I can. That's on ODARK 30 every Tuesday morning from 6 to 8 a.m., broadcasting live on FM 90.1, KZFR, kzfr.org.
Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you wearing boots, long underwear, gloves? Because it's a crypto winter. Ontario's self-proclaimed crypto king, Ontario, part of Canada, not the community east of Los Angeles. Well, it is east of Los Angeles, but it's a whole province. His self-proclaimed crypto king, Aiden Peterski, told a waitress at a driving range in Miami, quote, "I'll just pay everything in cash at the end," unquote. The interaction was part of a two-hour live stream Pleterski posted online. It's Pleterski, sorry. It's just one of several lengthy live streams the bankrupt 25-year-old has run during international trips to the UK, Miami, and LA this fall. A CBC review, that's the Canadian broadcasters, of those videos and his other social media posts found that Pleterski is traveling extensively despite his ongoing bankruptcy proceeding. Plans to fly to Australia on another trip this weekend. The posts also show Pleterski driving a McLaren and a Lamborghini, offering to fly a woman from Sydney to Melbourne for a night while he's in Australia, and attending a boxing match in Manchester. For more than a year now, Pleterski's investors have been trying to track down more than $30 million U.S. dollars they gave him to invest in cryptocurrency and foreign exchange. A Toronto-based bankruptcy proceeding that's being heard in Ontario Superior Court has recovered about $2.2 million for roughly 160 investors. The bankruptcy trustee, who's a federally regulated professional responsible for investigating the finances of a person or business that has gone bankrupt, his name is Rob Stelzer. He found that Pleterski only invested about 2% of investor funds while spending nearly $12 million on himself, renting private jets, going on vacations, adding luxury cars to his collection, and leasing a lakefront mansion prior to going bankrupt. Now his recent travels are raising questions about how the crypto king continues to fund his lifestyle while actively bankrupt, and what the bankruptcy proceeding can and can't do to investigate and potentially prevent his travel spending. "He has access to funds," said a fraud recovery lawyer. "It would seem," the lawyer continues, "that Mr. Pleterski is not deterred by anything that has gone on litigation-wise in the bankruptcy to continue on his reckless type of spending," unquote. Pleterski's lawyer, Michael Siman, did not respond to requests for comment about how his client is paying for his recent trips and lifestyle. The trustee, an accounting firm in the bankruptcy, said they're aware of Pleterski's travels. Although there is no prohibition regarding the travel of a bankrupt, the nature and amount of traveling has been lavish, said